Jesus paints a picture of opposites in the gospel today in broad strokes, like one of those melodramas you might pay to see on a dude ranch out west, you know, with good guys and bad guys and maybe someone who needs to be rescued. The Pharisee is the consummate law abider, right according to the system and its religious authorities, the kind of person society depends on, and he understandably wears his position as a badge of honor. The tax collector is caught up in the middle of an abusive economic system, but he knows that he's sinful. He extorts revenue for the Roman oppressors from his Jewish brothers, and he's held in contempt by both his boss and the people. No wonder he wears his shame like a shroud. But look at how Jesus complicates his short story. The religious leader is smug and sanctimonious, and the other man is unsure that there's a place for him in the community of faith at all. The so-called saint parades to the temple, while the sinner stands at a distance in a quiet display of humility. The righteous man stands up. The sinful man looks down. The Pharisee prays at length about himself, while the tax collector makes his confession in just a few pained words. The Pharisee puffs out his chest in public, and the publican beats his breast in sorrow. Still, according to Frederick Buechner, the parable neglects to mention that the Pharisee might have been singing Amazing Grace on his way to worship that day, or that as he said his prayers, maybe there were tears in his eyes. As Jesus presents the Pharisee, it's easy to dismiss him, but we would recognize him. Sure, he makes a mess of things here, but one can sense that he's caught up in the Spirit and truly moved with gratitude for the life that God has blessed him to live. Ask him on his way out of the synagogue what he thinks of the tax collector, and he'll tell you, "There but for the grace of God go I," which are words that we might use. What do we do with the Pharisee that we encounter in the scripture? Hate him? Love him? Try to wake him up? And what do we do with the Pharisee who caused the shots inside us? Am I the only one who's noticed that Jesus wrangles with Pharisees a lot, and it gets kind of personal over here? The parable also neglects to point out that the tax collector, after he's wiped his eyes, blown his nose, and gone home, will not be quitting his shady job anytime soon. He just can't see any other option. It's a nasty business, but someone has to do it, and why not him? The pay is good, so what's the big deal, he figures. Tomorrow, he'll take money from his neighbors again, hand some of it over to the empire, and put some aside for himself. I wonder, has he blithely sold out his principles? Or is he just a pragmatist who knows that business and politics is almost always painted in shades of gray and rarely in black or white? And why does Jesus tell so many stories about tax collectors anyway? Well, this narrator takes stereotypes and antitypes and turns them all upside down. So, to see the publican as honorable and the Pharisee as a creep makes the story false. It curdles it to a morality tale that sends us straight into the trap of saying, "God, we thank you that we're not like the Pharisee." Better to see him as he is, a thoroughly decent, committed man who's still asleep, and to see the publican as he is, a compromised, certified stinker who has woken up to the spiritual work that he's got to do. Which one are you? Are you one of the good guys who can slip into thinking that your way is always best? Or are you on the margin, convinced that the system is stacked against you and that there's nothing good that you can add? Paul Duke writes, I know which character the church depends on. I know which one pays the bills, teaches the lessons, visits the sick, feeds the hungry. To be honest, says one pastor, I'd love a church full of people with the Pharisees' commitments. People who are care enough to fast from actions and words that are death-dealing, courageous enough to tithe, and who thank God that they can. As in Jesus' day, it's people like the Pharisee who hold the community together and keep the faith with diligence and passion. So we can't color him sinister. He's not Darth Vader in a choir robe. He might be a better person than I am. And you might wonder if his prayer is really so bad. It's very similar to some classic prayers of gratitude from that time, including, I give you thanks, O Lord my God, that you have not set my portion with those who sit on street corners. Or, praise be the God who did not make me a heathen and who did not make me an uneducated person. Is the psalmist wrong to pray, I have avoided the ways of the violent? Why not be like the Pharisee and gaze on the mystery of having been spared a certain lot or a certain struggle and give honest thanks? But there's a rub. The Pharisee doesn't pray with his eyes toward God. He prays looking down on everybody else. The thankfulness that he expresses is always conditional. You see, there's a word in his prayer that's outside the Jewish form, and that one little word gives him away. He doesn't give thanks that God has spared him from being a thief or a rogue or an adulterer or a tax collector. No, he gives thanks that he can't be compared to those people. He says, God, I thank you that I'm not like any of them. Really? Imagine if that's what happened as you sat down at dinner. You're saying hello to your friends, and he says, you know, thank God I'm not like you. But sometimes you sit down with someone at dinner, and the person says, thank God I'm not like them. And we cluck together. But those words and that sentiment, he crosses from the grammar of gratitude to the language of elitism. Now, this can be a very subtle line that we might not notice as we cross it, but I'm afraid we do it all the time. At least I do. It's a zero-sum game, this kind of thinking, that believes that one can't be up unless others are down, which struggles to see the good in others and can't see the log in my own eye. What betrays us is an unexamined refusal of kinship, of believing that we are related to each other, that we're part of one family. And it shows up every time we use the language of us and them. Something like, I'm glad I'm not hard-hearted like she is. I'm glad I'm not emotional like he is. I'm glad I'm not a liberal. I'm glad I'm not a conservative. I'm glad I'm not smug. I'm glad I'm not self-righteous. I'm glad I'm not judgmental. Do you see? You can feel the distance that he creates or supports in his word. This, he says, this tax collector, the publican, is an object, not a person in this construction, a type for the Pharisee to compare himself to, not a labor to love. At this point, he stopped praying and started peeking. Coolly, he measures himself against the stranger and is quietly pleased with the difference that he sees. But hear me out. If the tax collector measures himself against the Pharisee in a similar but opposite way, well, then his prayer would be just as false. It's the competitive sideward glance about our brothers and sisters that Jesus is calling us to avoid. God is not about who's better than, smarter than, prettier than, richer than, holier than. God does not discriminate. We do. But God does not compare us against each other. You see, the God who blesses a particular type of person is a God who can be manipulated, favoring our causes or our parties or our opinions or our behaviors or our race or our gender or our neighborhood because we say so, instead of understanding that God favors what is right and what is good and what is life-giving, and that each of us is called to measure up to God's standard of justice and mercy instead of any of us settling for the status quo, or worse yet, unconsciously accepting the privilege of it. The tax collector, wrong as he is about so much in his life, well, he's got his eyes on the prize. He doesn't even notice the Pharisee as he's standing far off, taking his moral inventory and holding himself accountable. You see, he's looking down and deep within, and that's fitting for a person who's fighting to figure out how he's at odds with himself. I wonder, what if someone were to draw a cartoon of us at prayer with thought balloons over each of our heads? It might be pretty embarrassing to read what's on your mind right now, or what we sometimes think of others in spite of ourselves. I shudder to think what might be in the bubble that is over my head when I'm stuck in traffic, and what I might be thinking about my fellow travelers. Our capacity for such distancing is astonishing. In the nation now, what a rage is on to define ourselves over and against others and to assure ourselves by talking about the folks that we're not like and who we feel justified in criticizing because of the rightness of our positions or some perceived difference. Could there be a better indicator of our fear of embracing our personal shadow, our reluctance to fully know ourselves and reconcile how we are warring within? When our eyes shift away from our own shortcomings, we're a lot more likely to look at someone else and their wounds and their weakness and find comfort in claiming, well, at least I'm not like that. But if we are marching to Zion, the only way we'll get there is together, all of us. So the one whispering, God, be merciful to me, a sinner in the story, he may not be the best citizen, but he's looking at his own broken heart and offering it. Here, he's not unlike the woman who Jesus will soon see in the temple who throws her 2 pennies into the plate. Like the widow's gift, the tax collector's prayer is not given from any sense of abundance, but from his own sense of need. It's all that he holds in his crooked hands, this confession of brokenness and need. And as he offers it, somewhere, someone sings, come, we that love the Lord, and let our joys be known, join in a song of sweet accord, and thus surround the throne. Maybe as an exercise, as we listen to the news, we can try to pray for the ones that we deeply disagree with and see how that might change things. From the Pharisees' place, where we're right, flowers will never grow in the spring. That's not where seeds are planted or where they thrive. The place where we're right is hard and trampled like a kitchen yard. But doubts and loves, weakness confessed and shortcomings embraced, well, they dig up a world like a mole or a plow, and they make the soil of our lives and our community ripe for growing and new life. We all know that we stumble in various ways for various reasons, but what we all need when we flounder and fail is not moral condescension, but human engagement, not humiliation, but empathy, not shame, but hope. The person who's come to know the weakness of human nature has gained the experience of divine power, said a priest in the 7th century. Such a person never belittles anyone anymore. There's no time for that, because she knows that God is like a good and loving physician who heals each individual, each of us who's trying to make our way in progress. We won't save the world. We won't save the world until we learn to march together. After the tax collector's prayer, "Have mercy on me, a sinner," we can all begin, maybe for the first time in a long time, maybe feeling at home in yourself and with your people and with God in a way that you've been waiting to feel all your life. Maybe we can finally feel that we can begin to be reconciled by that confession of sin and shortcoming, by that confession of "there but for the grace of God go I," but not to make myself different from that other one, but to find myself in solidarity with the other one. Together, to have us know that it's only together that we can march to Zion. It's the old gospel reversal again. God undoing the order of things as they are in our systems, exalting those of low degree in a great surprise of mercy, filling those whose eyes and hearts are open with light enough to find our way home. Amen.